Hello and welcome to this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav, and what is surely going to sound like a repeat, Scottie Scheffler and Nelly Korda both won tournaments again this week. Scottie at the RBC Heritage the week after the Masters, while Nelly won the Chevron Championship for her second major title and fifth in a row, only the third player since 1978 to accomplish that feat. No sense comparing the two because, Rex, we can enjoy them equally, but what stood out from the week that was in the world of golf?
Why did they make them come back in Hilton Head? I mean, I know you play 72 holes, and I know there's a live joke in there, and whatever you want to make. But did we really need to see Scottie Scheffler come back out this morning and do what he did? Like, bogeying the last was that was a bit of an outlier. But the run that he's on, couldn't we have all agreed last night in the darkness to be like, yep, it's his. Let's just send him on his way.
Like, that was the best part, because that everyone knew that this was a foregone conclusion. He was up by five. He had three holes to play. He just had an incredible par in the 15th and near darkness, saving par from the trees after hitting it in the water after it was discovered. It was a mud ball. But even when it's cold and windy, even when the shots are two clubs longer than the previous couple of days, he was still hitting the correct shots. I mean, he was fine in the fairway. He was the middle of the green. He was no stress. 18 was playing drastically different than it had been the previous couple of days. You know, previously couple of days, you were, you know, hitting three wood or long iron off the tee to kind of keep it short of the sound, and then hitting a 7 or 8 iron into the green. Now he's like ripping a driver and playing well right, because it was absolutely howling. Like, Ludvig Åberg, one of the longest, straightest drivers of the golf ball, was hitting three wood into 18. So, Scottie, I think it was a little bit of a bummer to finish with a bogey, ending a streak of what was 66 consecutive holes without a drop shot. But I think the actual restart on Monday just like proved how his execution is just at another level right now. And I think the biggest surprise is that it came the week after what was such a momentous week at the Masters.
And they pointed out in the telecast that when he came back out on Monday morning, before the restart, he actually was watching what was going on the previous green to the group behind him. Like, he was curious of what was going to happen there. And it kind of shows you how locked in this guy is. And I will say, I did appreciate the way they had to play 18 this morning, Monday morning, because that is reminiscent of the way I play 18. It's usually a driver and a three wood into a wind, and you don't have any prayer of hitting it on the green. You just want to blow it as far left as possible without hitting it into those condos. But from an execution standpoint, and they flashed a graphic up during the telecast, and it's the quickest to get from his first victory to his 10th victory. And I think there was only one name ahead of his. Like, it took Tiger Woods longer to get from 1 to 10.
David Duval did it.
David Duval did it in 33 starts, right?
Yeah. While Scottie's doing it in 50.
I don't remember, like, it was good context because it made me kind of go back and sort of remember how quickly Duval started, you know, rattling things off, which it was probably a good lesson, because I think this is only going to lead us more to get a little breathless about Scottie and start comparing him to Tiger Woods like I did last week. And I think we probably need to take a bit of a pause, because you do want to see how birth of his first child. I mean, that it's going to be great. It's going to be a magical experience. He's going to be a fantastic father, but it impacts a player. It impacts a person differently in different stages of your life. You look at the fact he's never won after this. This could be his last win until next spring, because he only seems to be able to really win in the spring.
He's never won past April. This was the latest he's ever won. And it's just the week after the Masters.
And it's a statistical anomaly is all it is. I don't think there's anything to it, but it is pretty amazing to think that, because they brought this up on the telecast, that this could be his last victory of the year, and he would still easily be player of the year just based on what he's done to this point.
Three in a row player of the year. I mean, a player would need to win at least one major championship, probably two, if they're going to nip him for that season-long award. Also, isn't it amazing how PGA Tour players have children at like the absolute optimal time, where Meredith Scheffler didn't have the baby during the Masters. She's not going to have it during the PGA Championship. Scottie probably would have played the Nelson, his hometown event, when she is due next week, but he wasn't going to play the Zurich. And now it seems he will not play the Wells Fargo Championship at Quail Hollow, a signature event in the PGA Tour the week before the PGA Championship. It always just falls perfectly. Scottie said that the storyline was overblown at the Masters. It appeared again overblown at the RBC Heritage. She did not have the baby, and now Scottie will be able to be home and enjoy that with his new growing family. You mentioned the 10th win on the PGA Tour, Rex. I've been struck with Scottie's resume and the difficulty of the courses, of the fields. If you look at those 10 wins, all of those are either major championships, they're now signature events on the PGA Tour, or they were what would become signature events on the PGA Tour with the top fields, whether it was in Phoenix, used to have the match play, basically like a WGC Light, Bay Hill, Players Championship, Masters. To me, that shows Scotty's class, where when the competition is at the best, when the tournaments are the toughest, when the golf courses are set up the most extreme, that is when he prevails. He's not just picking off, you know, these summer series events against light fields. Like, he's doing it against the best of the best. And to me, that shows Scotty's brilliance right now. Like, if it's a difficult test, you know, if Scotty doesn't win, he's certainly going to be up there near the top of the leaderboard.
I can't believe we've made it this far into the podcast and haven't addressed this already. You and I both have a mea culpa from last week's podcast. Thanks to John from Connecticut for pointing out that you and I both messed up. I actually said that the UConn women's team had won the NCAA championship. They most certainly did not. The UConn men's team did. And your problem was, I'm going to let you clean that up on your own.
Paige Buchers. No. Buchers.
Buchers? Is that it?
Paige Buchers is how you pronounce the standout player from UConn, who will soon to be in 2025 the first pick of a WNBA draft. I butchered it last week. Apologies to the Buchers family and all of her associated fans, including our friend who emailed us.
You and I both, if we didn't clean that up.
No. Nope, going to Stanford next week. I did not need to see rioting in the streets. Did not want to see a protest when I arrived at LaGuardia. Didn't want to go into the Residence Inn in beautiful Stanford with people waving signs. No, Lavender, no. And I certainly don't want people to boycott the show.
And
so apologies to the Buchers.
And I do apologize. I gave the UConn women's team an extra national championship, which they do not need because they have plenty of them. So apologies to South Carolina, who actually won the national championship.
Yes. In fact, we watched that game. We were at Palmetto Golf Club. We watched the game, and no, UConn was not playing. What do you make, Rex, of Scotty's sort of historical position at this point? Like, we kept saying it for months where he's putting up ball striking numbers that we've not seen since Tiger Woods' prime. Now he's putting up, you know, wins and a level of dominance we have not seen since Tiger Woods' prime. Now 4 wins in his last 5 starts. And keep in mind, the one he did not win was when he misread the 4 or 5 foot putt in the 72nd hole at the Houston Open to lose to Stephen Yeager.
No, I'm going to push back on that.
This is crazy.
You're going to put it on that Scotty misread the putt. You know what? Stephen Yeager. That's what happened. Stephen Yeager came and took it from him. He took the thing from the world number one. That's right.
Did he?
I was taken
Yeager
last week.
Stephen Yeager did nothing on that back nine.
I was taken last week. I'm joking, of course. I was taken last week when I was standing on the putting green, and I was doing my story about how trying to compare this run that Scotty's on right now to Tiger. And footnote this, we always have to put the footnote in there. Like, it's not fair to compare anyone to Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods was a generational player and did it for a generation, is the line I kept coming back to. Scotty has done it for 2 years. It's been a really, really good 2 years. But if he does it for another 20, then we can have a different conversation. The part that got me as I was standing on the putting green, though, is I was trying to find, it was really hard in these limited fields now to find someone who played against Tiger Woods anywhere close to his prime. Think through it. Like, you know who was in the field last week, and you can kind of do it, do the math yourself. I could only really come up with 4 or 5 guys who did it. Justin Rose played against him in his prime. Certainly Lucas Glover was one that I sort of touched on that played against him in his prime. Brian Harman was the one that surprised me the most, because 2013 and 14, 13 was Harm's rookie year on the PGA Tour. And that was kind of Tiger's last 2 years as a truly dominant player, 13 and 14.
He won 8 times in 2012 and 2013 combined.
Yeah. So like 13 or 14, that was kind of the last run that Tiger was on. So it's sort of hard, but it stood out to me that the one guy on the green I probably should have talked to was Stephen Yeager. Didn't play against Tiger in his prime, but he's the only one in this run that's taken down the world number one.
I mean, he could end up being the answer to a trivia question.
Yeah.
You know, Stephen Yeager, again, did nothing on the back nine in Houston, made 9 consecutive pars, and yet he is the only player since the beginning of March who has beaten Scottie Scheffler. It does bring up a good point, Rex, where Tiger didn't really have a rival, so to speak. You know, to have a rival, there needs to be like a give and take. And certainly Phil Mickelson, Ernie Els, Retief Goosen, Vijay Singh, they all got their share during the Tiger Woods era. But I wouldn't say that he had a one-on-one rival. Right now, it doesn't feel like Scottie Scheffler has a one-on-one rival at all either. He's basically competing against the ghost of Tiger. Tiger's ball striking stats, Tiger's run of dominance. He's basically just trying to equal or match or get close to what Tiger Woods was doing in the mid-2000s. To me, this run could be even more captivating to the golf world if Scottie Scheffler does get a rival or at least a consistent threat. I think we all hoped that Rory McIlroy would be that guy because Rory has been sort of the central figure of everything that's gone on over the past couple of years. He has sort of this major competition with Brooks Koepka. It's now 5-4 in Brooks's favor. He has this sort of give and take with Patrick Cantlay that came to a head last year at the Ryder Cup, but they've been fighting over the future of the PGA Tour. Rory back in 2022 and even some of 2023, it was sort of the Rory versus Liv dynamic. It feels like John Rahm could have been that player for Scottie Scheffler to rival him. He's just 2 years older than Scottie. They had the duel at the 2021 Ryder Cup that apparently sent Scottie off on these winning ways. They had the back and forth last spring. Remember, with 6 combined wins, 4 for Rahm, 2 for Scottie through the end of the Masters. Who's going to step up? Or is anyone going to step up and make this even more thrilling of a competition? Or are we just going to sit back and watch Scottie Scheffler do Scottie Scheffler things?
He made a mess of Monday morning, but Ludvig Åberg would be the one that immediately comes to mind. And look, he's very, very young, and I don't want to – you're usually the one that jumps on these
– Not that young.
Not that young and much more accomplished than I think most people want to realize at this point. And I think the Masters – I mean, it showed probably the world a lot about Ludvig, but I think the bigger deal would be what it showed him is that he had never played in a major before. How is he going to respond? And I think he came out of that with a boatload of confidence. And you saw that even in Hilton Head. Like, look, he's not quite there yet, but I can imagine a scenario where 6 months from now, 12 months from now, we're talking about that as a really good rivalry just because of the dynamic between those two. You just mentioned how he's a bit of a robot. That one, there's no curve to his golf ball. He hits it.
Do they have the personalities though? I mean, don't you have to have a clash of personalities or conflict?
I don't think we have rivalry. We've addressed this. I mean, the tour is a Marvel movie without a villain is the line I used during the Masters. And I think that's not a bad thing necessarily. You have a lot of leading men. And I think when you, on the same weekend, you had Scottie Scheffler winning, you had Billy Horschel winning, you had Nelly Korda winning. Like all of those people are unbelievably good at golf. They're all just touched by the hand of God. But personality wise, do they look like they're going to conflict with anybody? I mean, as edgy as Scottie has ever gotten, I think it was at Bay Hill this year. That's as edgy as I've ever seen him get in a press conference when he was asked something about LIV Golf. Don't even remember exactly what the question was. And he sort of shot back with a bit of an edge that, why are you asking me? Ask the ones who joined LIV Golf. That's as controversial. That's as edgy as he's ever been in his career. We just don't who even if you had a player, like let's say it is going to be, I don't know, pick someone out of a hat that's not a LIV player yet. Is there a personality conflict there?
Not a LIV player yet.
Not a LIV player yet. Controversial there? No. If Brooks comes back, I can imagine that would be a pretty fun rivalry if John Rahm comes back. I mean, those are all kind of big ifs.
I mean, John was the obvious choice to me, who could have
Brooks
been.
I think the Netflix dynamic there, and some of it's manufactured and performative, but I think
there's like an 8-year age gap between those two players, so I'm not so sure about that. That's why, like, I think Ludvig Åberg is a phenomenal player, and he's clearly going to win his fair share of golf tournaments, including major championships. But I think to have a full-blown rivalry, there needs to be some sort of conflict. Rory McIlroy is a very polarizing presence for not just PGA Tour players, but golf fans as well. And so that's why he's sort of filled this rivalry void and taken on various foes over the past couple of years. The player who I think actually has the best chance, you said, you know, throw a name in the hat. I think it could be Wyndham Clark. Wyndham Clark, now into the top 5 in the world rankings, take with the world rankings with a grain of salt at the moment. It's basically a PGA Tour ranking, but he at least has won a major championship over the past 10 months, just like Scottie Scheffler has done. He won Pebble Beach earlier this year, a signature event. He has 3 other top threes now, including a couple runner-up finishes and then a top 3 this past week at the RBC Heritage and Signature events to Scottie Scheffler, but he has a personality where he is unafraid of Scottie Scheffler. He relishes the chance and the challenge of going up against Scottie Scheffler. I'm not saying they're going to be a one-for-one rival and that all of a sudden Wyndham Clark is going to put together a resume that looks like Tiger Woods' prime in terms of the level of dominance that we've now seen from Scottie Scheffler. But I do think that he can sort of be a perpetual thorn in Scottie's side, so to speak, win a couple of signature events each year, challenge him in the major championships. He has all of the tools, does Wyndham Clark, to be that sort of player, whether it's length off the tee, whether it's sky-high approach play, whether it's being a very underrated putter, if not a bit inconsistent. But to me, Wyndham Clark is that guy, at least currently, who has the best chance to do so in 2024.
I see what you're saying. Like, there's some tools there. I would counter and say you still don't have anything close to a personality conflict between those two. And you're not going to, again, I could give you all morning
Wyndham's, long. Wyndham's rubbed a couple people the wrong way.
Not Scotty.
With sort of his, like, confidence and really, his brashness.
Like, you really think Scotty cares one way or the other, how someone, you know, comes across? Like, I just don't know that you're going to have that based on the cast of characters we have right now. So Grayson Murray has rubbed some people the wrong way. Like, he has said some things. We all know what was the exchange between Grayson and Rory McIlroy at the meeting last June.
Not rivals. Canada.
Not rivals. I mean, they're not. I mean, Grayson Murray's won on the PGA Tour. He's a fine player. He's not a rival of Rory. He's certainly not a rival of Scotty. I think that's what you run into. If it's not going to be a Brooks, or if it's not going to be, I don't even know if John Rahm qualifies in my mind, because certainly he has the tools to rival, and he showed it over the last year to, you know, to be that number one, number two in the world, going back and forth kind of thing. But a personality, I mean, from a personality standpoint, it's not there. Throughout Tiger Woods's prime,
John Rahm's personality is not conducive to having a polarizing relationship. I think there's a lot of mutual respect. There's a lot of mutual respect between those two.
I mean,
but I certainly think John Rahm could get under his skin.
I think maybe this has more to do with Scotty than it does with anyone else, because I don't think anyone can at this point get under his skin. Not certainly the way he's playing right now from a competitive standpoint, but even a personality conflict. When Tiger Woods was at his best, golf was at its best when Phil was at his best, because you always had Tiger. He was the constant. But when Phil found a way to play some good golf and to challenge Tiger Woods, that's when you had the personality conflict. You were either a Tiger guy or a Phil guy. There was nothing in between. You really don't have that now. Like, how many times do you hear a golf fan say, Scotty's not my cup of tea? No one says that.
No.
Like, who would say that?
No one. And like, PGA Tour players like absolutely love him. They don't talk just about the quality of his golf game, but how great of a human being.
It was Max Homa last week gushing about he's a great player, he's a great person, and that makes me angry because I really wish I could hate him. That was Max's line last week. Like, I wish I could hate him. I wish I could have some animosity towards him, but it's just not there.
I do think we can enjoy it on its own, and there's always this rush to compare him and sort of extrapolate what we're watching in real time. I wish we could just sit back and like enjoy it. Like, Scottie Scheffler is a joy to watch in person. Again, I hear from my friends. I hear from golf fans on social media. We see the YouTube comments where they think Scottie Scheffler is boring. They think he's bland. They think he's just uninteresting. Again, if you have the opportunity, watch Scottie Scheffler in person, and I think you will have a greater appreciation for what we're actually watching. I think in 10 years we could be looking back and say, like, wow, like the Scottie Scheffler era. We were part of it, and it was absolutely breathtaking.
I think the golf, his brand of golf, is entertaining. Like, if you just took all the personality stuff out of it and just watched him play the game, I mean, just his swing is unique in and of itself. You wouldn't particularly teach that kind of footwork. I had this conversation last week, and I might have brought it up on the podcast. The idea that someone said that right now your boy Oberg is the best ball striker on the tour. Oberg. Is the best ball striker on the tour right now. And these guys I was playing golf with, it was Andrew Bradley, our producer, and it was Colin Swatton, who works for XM Sirius Radio, he's a swing coach on tour. And I pushed back saying, no, statistically, Scottie Scheffler is the best ball striker on the PGA Tour right now. And it led to the sort of debate about the idea that Scottie Scheffler is the best golfer in the world right now. He knows how to play golf better than anyone else. But Colin Swatton's argument was, and I get where he's coming from if you're just going to teach the golf swing, Ludwig is probably the one you're going to lean towards. You're not going to teach anybody
golf swing. You teach them how to score. Teach them how to play golf.
Yeah.
Like Ludwig Oberg's swing is near flawless. Like, I don't know enough about the golf swing to say his swing is better than Adam Scott's.
Like, I don't know how Adam Scott ever mishit a shot in his career based on that swing. I mean, you could sit there and break it down, and people who are much smarter and know much more about the golf swing than me have done it. I don't know how he ever missed a shot. I think Ludwig is in that exact same category. However, when you put them on the golf course and you bring in all the variables that make golf such the beautiful game that it is, that's when Scotty's at his best.
Scotty does everything. Well, we had said for months, right, that if Scotty Scheffler just putts average, he's going to win by multiple shots. Well, at the RBC Heritage, he putted average. He was outside the top 30 in putting, and yet he won by 3 shots after the bogey on the 72nd hole. Just another level right now is Scotty Scheffler. Speaking of inevitable, try to say that 3 times fast.
Well done.
Nelly Korda, very similar situation, Rex, to Scotty at the Masters, where Nelly Korda is entering the Chevron Championship as the prohibitive favorite. She withstood a couple of challenges in the final round, and then she pulled away, like Scotty did, for her second major title. That's now 5 in a row on the LPGA. Only Annika Sörenstam in 2004 and 2005 and Nancy Lopez in 1978 have done this, winning 5 in a row. Nelly Korda is in the field this week in LA as she tries to hold the record for herself. What do you think of Nelly continuing to be in a class of her own on the women's tour?
You did a really good story on NBC Sports. .com/golf. Sorry, that doesn't come out as easy as it used to. A tough day yesterday. Tough day. Middle kid's 21st birthday.
We're gonna get into it. Don't you worry.
Yeah, I'm not doing great this morning. I think it's, and again, it's hard to enjoy these things in the moment because you look at what she's accomplished. And I thought your story, and there was another story I thought on ESPN that did a really good job of pointing out that it was less than 2 years ago when she was dealing with some major health issues. Like, there is a compelling story here that I don't think the average golf fan has taken the time to learn to understand. And I would strongly suggest everyone does, because even though a little bit like Scotty Scheffler, in my mind, she can come off as a bit of a robot sometimes. And like, I think the best in the game probably should come off as a bit of a robot sometimes, because that's probably the way you should play the game. If everybody played the game like Jordan Spieth, yes, it would be wildly more entertaining, but no one would be able to go on these dominant runs, because since Jordan Spieth in 2015, that's kind of the beauty of his game. He bounces around a lot. You don't know what you're going to get when it comes to Nelly or when it comes to Scotty Scheffler. They are such known commodities. But unlike Scotty Scheffler, I mean, there's a really compelling and interesting story that she was dealing with some very, very serious health stuff. It wasn't about golf less than 2 years ago. It was about, am I going to survive? How am I going to be able to live a normal life? So I think the middle of the run that she's in right now, at least in my mind, from a storytelling standpoint, is much more compelling than what Scotty's doing.
Yeah, and look, Nelly Korda has been loath to discuss exactly what she was dealing with in 2022. What we do know is that she had a blood clot that required surgery that cost her a couple months during the 2022 season. In fact, she pushed back and actually separated with her swing coach, Jamie Mulligan, for a time period. Jamie Mulligan, a longtime coach to Patrick Cantlay, of course, told Golf Week's Beth Ann Nichols that, you know, it was a pretty serious situation that happened, the 2022 Players Championship, where Nelly was doing some sort of event and she felt like some numbness and some tingling and her hands were turning color. And all of a sudden, Jamie Mulligan had to call Jay Monahan, who made some other calls. And all of a sudden, Nelly Korda was in the hospital and having surgery for what could be a pretty serious issue. She has not wanted to really discuss this at all. She did pull back the curtain, as you mentioned, though, on Sunday night after winning the Chevron, just saying how in 2021, Nelly Korda had a breakout year. She won 4 times. She won her first major championship. And then she had these setbacks. First in 2022 with the blood clot. She also had some back pain that cost her more than a month during 2023. But she had even said that doubt started to creep in. She started listening to some quote unquote outside voices who were kind of wondering, you know, would she ever be healthy again? Could she ever put it all together during a magical season? You know, what would happen if she got fully healthy and put it all together? I think obviously now we know the answer. This is exactly what she is capable of doing over this stretch, over her past 5 tournaments, which is stretched since the end of January. She's won in a variety of different ways, even in a variety of different formats, winning both stroke play and the match play event as well. She just seems, Rex, like such a spectacular player. She has the length. She has the precision with the irons. She's a good enough if not above average putter and chipper of the golf ball. And she does seem to be getting increasingly comfortable in her own skin. If you remove kind of the injury and health related stuff, which she clearly does not want to get into, you know, I think there's this want for her, and we talked about it on the podcast last week, to take women's game to new heights, to basically be the LPGA's Caitlin Clark, to be more visible, to stump for more coverage. Nelly said on Sunday night that it's sort of up to the TV partners to give the LPGA players a bigger stage. But it is clear that she's not doing so. I would say she's not adamant. You know, she's not pounding her hands on the table and saying this is what we want. It's clear that's not her personality. And I think it's cool that she's doing it her own way, on her own terms, and right now just winning in this sort of clear and utter dominance should be enough for Nelly Korda and her fans right now.
It should be enough. And again, this is kind of the conversation we had last week, and it's just going to carry on as long as these two keep doing what they're doing and dominating golf in a way. And it goes to the personality. Like in Caitlin Clark's situation, not only did she do amazing things on the basketball court and set records and just be wildly entertaining, she was also a personality. She is a personality. If you watch Saturday Night Live, you came walked away with the idea that, oh, wow, she's really funny and self-deprecating, all the things that we like to see in our athletes. Oh, look at that, a Masters Cup. Where'd you get that? I don't know if it's in either one of their personality, though. To your point, I think both Scotty and Nelly are very private people. They don't particularly like they're not going to show up on Saturday Live. That's just not going to happen as the ultimate litmus test on this. And it kind of came up in a radio interview I did this weekend. Is it, and it's sort of the sports radio cliche, but is it better when the game has a dominant player versus just a collective group, which is what we kind of had in men's professional golf for the last few years? And the answer is not very easy for me because it depends on who that dominant player is. If it's Tiger Woods and he's doing generational things and he's bringing people to the game who aren't really associated with golf anymore, and even Tiger Woods at his best on the course was at his worst with the media where he just didn't give us anything, he was still a very compelling figure just because of what he was able to do on the golf course. By comparison, if you have a player like Scotty or Nelly who are still doing wonderful things on the golf course, but neither one of them particularly want to be performative, which I can appreciate. Like, you are out here to compete. I'm out here to win and to play golf as well as I can. I don't need to stand up on stage and perform for you. This is what my performance is, what I do when I have a golf club in my hand. The opposite of that, and I've had conversations with folks from the TGL, from the golf league that's going to start. That's very much performative. Like, the idea being that you can't be that player with the blinders on if you're going to get on stage and do this for us. So it is a compelling, interesting conversation, because there's so very few people who are like, take Brooks, for example. When he was dominant, he was still entertaining because of how indifferent he was to everything else around him. Scotty doesn't have any of that. Nelly doesn't have any of that.
Yeah, like I remember back in the mid-2000s when Lorena Ochoa kind of burst on the scene. And Lorena Ochoa, if you guys forgot, won 14 tournaments in 2006 and 2007 combined. That run, I remember as a golf fan, felt very energizing and very vibrant, and it felt like something special was happening, because I think in large part because of her personality. She was such a bubbly presence. She adored the cameras. She loved the fans. She was very open about her professional and even her personal goals. Like, she let us in as golf fans, and I think that's what helped drive her personality. And I think that's why everyone was so shook when she retired sort of abruptly after a 27 win career, which really came sort of hot and heavy. Nelly is not going to, I don't think, ever get to that point where she's going to let us in as fans. It is amazing how at the exact same time we have number one in the world Americans who are in their mid 20s, who are very similar personality wise, who are very grounded, who are very family first. Nelly is extremely family first, with both her parents going to every single tournament. Obviously, her sister Jessica, who just had a baby, was a longtime stalwart on the LPGA as well. You think about Scotty and now having a baby, but his parents, his sisters are always sort of omnipresent at golf tournaments as well. I'm not saying it's good or bad, but it is remarkable how these players who talk about their bubble, who talk about being grounded, who talk about being humble, have now achieved sort of not unprecedented success, but success we haven't seen in two decades. And the parallels and the similarities are pretty striking.
Well, and when you look, and I think it was in the ESPN.com story that I was reading about, and I guess Annika Sorenstam was on Golf Channel, and she was talking about this is what Nelly would be thinking. And I love the idea that Annika went straight back to the assassin. She went back to the cold-blooded competitive killer, where it was, you don't pay attention to what you've done the last 5 weeks, like going to Los Angeles next week, trying to win for the sixth event in a row. Everything that's happens behind you, that has nothing to do with anything going forward. And it shows a side of what it takes to be able to pull something like this off. Like, we so rarely see these types of runs, and it's because you have to be so cold-blooded. You have to just be the robot. You have to forget about, there is no celebrating. I mean, we kid about Scotty all the time, and oh, he slipped into some sort of dive bar in Dallas and had one drink to celebrate the Masters. I'm like, well, what's the use? Like, just go home. But that's kind of what it takes. It takes that sort of singular mentality, and Nelly has it. And you're right. I mean, even though I think personality-wise, they're different, I do think Scotty will be a little bit playful, and he'll crack the door a little bit if you give him an opportunity. I haven't seen that from Nelly, but certainly when it comes to, you're right, keeping the circle really, really small, keeping the focus, very hyper-focused going forward, nothing behind. They're the same creatures.
Sincere apologies, as it is Monday morning, 9:30 a.m. when we were doing this podcast, and the long guy has just busted out the blower. He's doing so on our front patio. So I will try to make this brief as I kick it to you. We talk so much about what they, Scottie Scheffler and Nelly Korda, are doing now. How about Rex, what could be? And 15-year-old Miles Russell, a Jacksonville Beach native, just tied for 20th at the Korn Ferry Tour event in Florida. That was enough to earn another start this week on the KFT. As someone who just celebrated his son's 21st birthday by drinking around the world at Epcot, we'll certainly get into exact breakdown of what was consumed. What are your thoughts on what this kid is accomplishing at such a young age?
When you look across the board in this, you know, this kid, you call him the 15-year-old, is probably the best example, where it just seems like younger golfers are better prepared, bigger, stronger, faster than they ever were in the past. Because if you'd have told me this 20 years ago, and I think Ty Tryon probably would be the comp going back all of those years. I mean, he was special. That was generational, what Ty was doing. And I remember having the big, long conversation about, well, he's going to go straight from high school to the PGA Tour. And everyone was just clutching pearls because it was going to ruin the game. That we can't have this. We can't have players going straight from high school to the PGA Tour because they're not equipped, either from a personality standpoint or from a competitive standpoint or from a physical standpoint. And my argument then, and it kind of came to pass, is we're not going to run into this. Like, this isn't going to happen very often. Most 99.9% of the time, a player is going to be really good coming out of high school, but they're still going to go to some sort of one of these, you know, mercenary colleges like Oklahoma State, where they can go and essentially be, you know, tour pros who masquerade as college players. I think that was then. Now, I don't know if this is going to be a surprise. I read that story last night, and I wasn't overly surprised, shocked by it. And I am shocked in the context that, yes, I have three kids, and to imagine that any of them could have done anything at that level at 15 kind of is impossible for me to wrap my mind around. But you see it better than I do, covering the college game, which you'll get into here shortly. They're just better prepared. I mean, as much as we wanted to look at Ludwig and say, no, he's not prepared for the professional ranks, no, coming out of Texas Tech, no, he's not prepared for the Ryder Cup, no, he's not prepared for his first major. Of course he is. Well, like, why wouldn't he be? They have access to all the things that a modern tour pro have. So why wouldn't they be prepared?
This is going to be a very fascinating case study, in my opinion, because Miles Russell is clearly an incredible and a precocious talent who, by all accounts, I've got a friend who knows the family quite well, like a very grounded kid at age 15.
Knock life. But
you look at his accomplishments, where he was the AJGA Player of the Year, breaking Tiger Woods' age record. In the process, he's already won the junior players, which is an AJGA Invitational. He's already won the junior PGA by 7 shots. Like, as someone who grew up in the Ty Tryon era, I'm always a little hesitant to see stories like this. But the other part of me, as you mentioned, is I'm not really surprised. Like, I covered Justin Thomas making the cut at the Wyndham Championship. I covered Jordan Spieth making the cut as a 16-year-old at the 2010 Nelson. We were both at the Masters when Guanten Long made the cut, which is still an amazing accomplishment. I don't think we talk about this enough. 14-year-old Guanten Long, who was in the Masters field by virtue of winning the Asia-Pacific Amateur Championship, made the cut at the Masters at the age of 14. He's not panned out at all, but that is still definition of precocious. Like, I'm not surprised in that sense because we've seen it. And players today have access to better technology. They have better training. They have better advanced statistics that could help optimize their games. And I think Miles Russell is so young now that we have time to see how this is all going to play out. Even if he does eschew college, like, he can't join the tour, the PGA Tour, until he's 18 years old. So, like, he's only going to get bigger. He's only get faster. He's only going to get stronger. In theory, he would only get better. On the other side of the coin, though, Rex, as you mentioned, there is definitely a growing trend among the best players to stay in school longer, with the opportunities that have arisen through PGA Tour University sort of incentivizing players to stay through at least their junior year, and in some cases even their senior year, to get PGA Tour status. I mean, Gordon Sargent literally just did it. He's the number one ranked amateur in the world traditionally. Those players, whether it was JT, whether it was Spieth, whether it was Ricky, they're leaving after three semesters, after 2 years, after 3 years, if they really wanted to get some additional seasoning. You're not seeing that now. You're seeing more fully formed individuals playing on the PGA Tour. And for proof, all you need to do is look at the top 10 players in the world ranking. Scotty Scheffler, four-year player. Wyndham Clark, four-year player. John Rahm, four-year player. Max Homa, four-year player. Kyle Morikawa, four-year player. Ludvig Åberg, four-year player. Like, that is now the trend, that when you get on the PGA Tour at 21, 22, 23 years old, you're a fully formed adult and can have success right away. So there's two interesting dynamics at work, where you have a really young, precocious talent, but you have this trend that is, I think, a clear indicator that more seasoning can kind of better prepare you for what PGA Tour life is going to be. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out over the next 2 or 3 years, and if he even goes to college.
Well, and the other side of that coin would be Nick Dunlap, which we had long conversations about earlier this year. And I think you actually sort of flirted with the idea. You walked to the line. You weren't willing to jump on the other side, but you flirted with the idea maybe he stays in school, you know, one more year after winning at the American Express. I immediately pushed back and said, I see where you're coming from. And there is certainly something to be said for doing a full 4 years in college, because you're right. When they turn pro, and Lupe, again, is the best example of this, fully formed adults, they're ready for a PGA Tour career. In this particular case, though, and maybe based on what we've seen out of Nick Dunlap since the American Express, maybe he would have been better off with one more year in school. However, given what was up for grabs this particular year, and this is just a 2024 issue with the designated events and what he was suddenly qualified for and the opportunities that he had, I thought it was ridiculous to even consider anything else. And I'm going to stick with that take, but I see where you're coming from.
Just to put a fine point on this, I did not say he should stay in school for another year. I said he should stay in school for a couple more months, see the end of his sophomore season through. When you look at Nick Dunlap's statistics on the PGA Tour, does not have a single top 10 since winning the American Express. I don't think that's because it was a fluke performance at PGA West. In fact, I think he's a very good player who will have a very good career. It's just so much happening so quickly that he was ill-prepared to make the jump at this time, when a couple more months to get settled would, I think, have behooved him. Again, I understand the different dynamics. I understand that he had to jump at that point to maximize his profitability, to maximize his status, to give himself the best runway to have success in the PGA Tour. But I don't think it's any surprise at this point that he has not done all that well on the PGA Tour. We mentioned Rex, your son, we'll call him Trevor. We don't want to get him getting any sort of feedback from the folks on YouTube. How was the 21st birthday at Epcot? And if you guys have not done it, drinking around the world, can you fill in the folks at home?
It was his idea to do this. I'm not quite sure why. I don't know where he got the idea from. But there's a couple of things. Apparently, this is something, like, I suggest anyone Google it who has any interest in it, because there's like a detailed plan that you have to have going into this. So you start in Mexico. That's if you come into the park and you take a left, that's the first country you come to. And Mexico was perfect. Had a light lunch, had a little cerveza. It's easy, a light start, you can get going. Where we immediately ran into trouble was, I don't know if you know this, the next country is Norway. And I don't know if you know this, but there's no real beer associated with Norway, at least not in what Epcot believes Norway to believe. So you're already going down a bad road, because you end up having some sort of really heavy alcohol, coffee type thing I forget what it was called. Like it, like, yeah, like a,
you just have like vodka,
like a Viking. And yeah, like it, whatever it was called, it, it got us off to a really, really bad start, and everything kind of spirals from there. I will say the highlight of the day is clearly Italy, which we spent the most amount of time in.
Always.
Yeah, best, France
best,
was fun.
Best food and best drinks.
Best food, best drinks. Italy was fun. France was fun. The one that throws me, and I sent you a picture of this just to make the point, is so when we got to the American exhibit country, whatever it is you want to call it, like give me the distinctly American drink. And I guess whiskey would be the obvious choice.
Yeah, I mean, Jack Daniels, if you want to be truly American. I threw out Miller Lite as like a distinctly American Budweiser. Drink. Not saying Budweiser. It's good. Ugh. Yeah. Bud Heavy is just so disgusting. Please don't at me. It's not good.
You set yourself up for pain on that one. Anyway, there wasn't one there. And as a side note, I think I sent you a picture of the smoker in front of the American display, which both of us were
very American.
Distinctly American thing. But as I sent this to you, my son was standing next to me and he goes, "Dad, that's not a real smoker." And I'm going, "What are you talking about? Look, there's actually smoke coming out of it. It's not a real smoker. It's a Disney, it's a display." Like, and they do have smoke coming out of it, and there's like stains on the side of it. And I'm like, "Oh, no, you can see the smoke coming out of it." And then I realized that they're not doing anything. Like, that's just Disney.
And that's what happens after you do like 6 to 7 drinks. Is all of a sudden you start imagining smokers dead. That's absolutely not true. So it is like 10 stops. Is it not?
I believe it's 11 stops. If my wife's post on Facebook was correct last night, it's 11 stops. And by the time we got to the last one, you called it like that last Labatt's Blue. I think I did it right. Oh. Labatt's Blue. Yeah. That did not go down well. That's a tough way to end the day. That's a tough scene.
You're really choking it down. And trust me, I love beer as much as anyone, but the Labatt's Blue at the end of a very long day, it's typically very hot whenever you drink around the world. At Epcot, like it just sits very heavy, particularly on that Uber ride back home. We're recording this podcast at 9:45 a.m. Trevor has not yet been seen after his trip around the world, although you look bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Kudos.
I feel like I actually went around the world, not just at Epcot, but I feel like I walked around the world yesterday. That's what I feel like.
Magellan Hoggard. Yeah. You can start calling him that. From now on, that is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. We'll be back in about 48 hours for a preview podcast of a pretty busy week in the world of golf, whether it's the Zurich Classic, Live Adelaide. I'm sure you've seen all the promotional material for that one, as well as Nelly Korda's bid for a record-setting 6 in a row. So again, be back on Wednesday, 48 hours from now, for a preview podcast. In the meantime, you guys know the drill, nbcsports.com/golf. For the latest news, updates, features, and column from the world of golf. Thanks as always for listening. Thanks for the support. We'll talk to you guys in a couple of days.